This is Teddy Roosevelt, just back from charging up San Juan Hill. Damn it, Professor Buzzkill was already at the top, collecting historical evidence, busting myths, and taking names. I have to admit that he's a worthy competitor and a damn fine rough rider. Join me in listening to this episode. It's sure to be bully.
Hello, yes, you're here to join us on Professor Buzzkill. We are at the 50th anniversary of the Martin Luther King assassination in 1968. And what we want to talk about today is the unknown Martin Luther King. Fortunately, here in the Buzzkill Bunker in the Institute is Professor Nash from Penn State, who not only knows an awful lot about this, but has given public talks and lots of lectures on this, and we're so grateful that he's here to enlighten us about so many things about Martin Luther King that we don't know that we should know. How are you, Professor?
I'm doing great. Happy to be here.
A lot of these things seem to come up because Martin Luther King has been sort of given credit for, A, things he didn't say, which we talk about a lot on our show, but also things that he didn't do and all things that he did do that have been kind of forgotten about.
Right. He's become sort of a brand.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So brands get ripped out of history sometimes and, the edges get filed off and stuff gets airbrushed and complexity is lost and he becomes just this sort of simple thing. So I think it's really important to, on this occasion, to restore Martin Luther King's, well, first of all, his human nature, right?
Right.
The fact that he's a complicated human being like everybody else, that there's complexity in his life and in his story. And perhaps most importantly of all is just how controversial he was and is. And for example, politically, he was, especially in his last few years, a lot more radical than I think a lot of people think. And he becomes, like a lot of people, we talked about this with JFK, he becomes not only a brand, but becomes a football. In other words, he gets thrown around, he gets put to various uses by various groups for their own purposes.
Yeah.
And that isn't necessarily the way that good history gets produced.
No, because he's often misused when he gets used in that way.
Right, and there was an example just recently which happened during Super Bowl 52, which was there was an ad for Ram trucks in which Martin Luther King's famous Drum Major Instinct sermon, in other words, he gave a sermon which he referred to himself as a drum major. And in the ad, they play part of his sermon in which he talks about the importance of serving others over visuals of people who own Ram trucks doing various service-oriented activities.
Delivering things to the needy.
Yeah, to a shelter or whatever. So right away, there were obviously a lot of critics of this ad.
Yeah, sure.
Not only is it tasteless, right? You're using Martin Luther King Jr. to hawk stuff.
Right.
But also, if you look at that sermon, in that same sermon, King criticized the advertising industry. So this is the sort of thing. It's like you're not just using King in a commercial. You know, this has ramifications.
Yeah,
pardon the term. This has effects when it comes to history and the role of history in public life and in popular culture, and then also memory.
Right? And in so many of these cases, it's not just the words he used being. They're taken out, certain things are taken out that might have something, the sermon or the speech might have something completely different.
Right.
And in the whole sermon or speech. So people are picking and choosing what they want, and they're often choosing stuff that is not relevant.
Right. We're ripping it out of context, if you just have the part of the sermon about service, you might think he would approve of this ad.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then if you look at the rest of the sermon, it's like, no, he probably wouldn't because he has a real problem with advertising and manipulation and what advertisers do.
Yeah. And there's certainly nothing more manipulative than a Super Bowl.
Right.
Ad.
But on the other hand, what we've also done, I think a lot of us, in some ways, myself included, we've sort of elevated King to sainthood.
Yes.
And that we often lose track of his very human qualities and some of his flaws.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm not going to harp on these, but people should understand that he, like almost all other humans ever, was not a saint.
No.
And for example,
and never would have claimed to be.
Never would have claimed to be. Thank you. Yes, absolutely true. But this was a big deal when it was discovered in the early 1990s, but I think it's been forgotten since. And that is, remember, he is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He got a PhD in theology from Boston University in 1955.
Yeah.
It's quite clear now, and an official committee at Boston University determined this, that in his PhD dissertation, he was guilty of multiple cases of plagiarism.
Right, right.
In other words, presenting someone else's work as if it weren't his own.
And well, extensive.
Extensive, yes. Yeah. If he were a PhD student today, it would have gotten him a lot of trouble.
Right,
true. One way or another, if it was discovered while he was doing it. Now, the committee also decided that, or determined that he had, quote, made an intelligent contribution to scholarship.
Right.
So it's not like it was completely plagiarized
or
like made no contribution to the field. Nevertheless, his academic credentials have sort of a cloud over them.
They weren't revoked by Boston
University. They did not take away his doctorate. So that's part of it. It is also true, and if you look at biographies like David Garrow, some of the major biographies, it's pretty clear that he was unfaithful to his wife.
Now, this is something that we don't hear about a lot, and maybe that's because Coretta Scott King is still alive.
Right. That's part of it. And not to defend him, but let's keep in mind the context. In the 1960s, it was pretty normal, and you know, we talked about this with JFK, right?
Right.
Pretty normal, and most people would just sort of yawn if they found out that such and such a leading public figure who was male was sleeping around. It happened quite a bit. It's pretty clear that King was doing that. He was, at the very least, and some of his colleagues in the civil rights movement wrote about this later on.
Yeah, right.
Some of them tried to backtrack, and some of them claimed it was just emotional, not physical. Nevertheless, it's pretty clear that he had multiple extramarital affairs. This was an obsession, by the way, if I can just interject, of J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah, this seems so odd to me.
J. Edgar Hoover hated Martin Luther King Jr., thought he was a communist, thought he was one of the greatest threats to the Republic, harassed and surveilled him for years, including breaking the law, including engaging in some ridiculous skullduggery. He had wiretaps put on King's phones.
Yeah.
He repeatedly in private referred to King as a tomcat.
Yeah, which means tomcatting around used to be sleeping
exactly.
around.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so there was not only did he hate Martin Luther King Jr., but he was particularly exercised about the idea that King was at least a hypocrite when it came to his married life.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's this heavily documented. In fact, you can read you can see the original online of this anonymous letter that was sent to Martin Luther King Jr. by the FBI. This was revealed in the 70s when FBI's dirty laundry came out, a lot of it. That the tapes, the secret tapes of Martin Luther King Jr. engaged in extramarital trysts, those tapes were sent along with an anonymous letter to Martin Luther King Jr. essentially saying, you're a hypocrite, you're a disgrace, you should kill yourself.
And this is 1964.
This is right around the time he receives the Nobel Peace Prize.
Okay, so this must... I think
King Ned is not Hoover.
Hoover.
Let me be clear about that.
In 1963, King is reaching the peak of his influence in the United States with the March on Washington speech. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in 1964, he receives a Nobel Prize. It's almost as if Hoover is those two things are the last straw, and he's just got to do this.
Yeah. It's quite clear that Hoover cannot abide the idea that someone like Martin Luther King Jr. has so much influence and so much prestige. It becomes an obsession.
It's a sick obsession, yeah.
Right. There's also more in terms of politics and the civil rights movement itself. I think King, in some cases, deserves criticism for both his tactics and his strategy.
Okay, I'm certain most people haven't heard about.
In other words, and you know, we can all acknowledge that he played a brilliant role in gaining the major successes of the civil rights movement, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he is its acknowledged leader for a very good reason and will always be. Nevertheless, it doesn't mean he always made the best decisions or made the right moves. For example, Birmingham in 1963 gets, understandably, all the attention because it was successful.
Yeah,
the protest in Birmingham, April, May 1963 that led to JFK to introduce the Civil Rights Act. I mean, this is where, you know, they deploy the dogs and the fire hoses. It's very, very famous. What people often don't know is the context of that. The previous year, 1962, King and his people in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had focused their efforts on a place called Albany, Georgia.
Right, right.
And it was a big push in that town to integrate. And it failed, partly because there the head of police was very clever and did not engage in violence.
Oh, okay. So he did the opposite of the Bull Connor.
Right. He played it cool, and it was brilliant. And the movement basically failed there, which reveals an aspect of the nonviolent passive resistance strategy, which often is overlooked, which is it only works if your opponent is violent.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's them going to Birmingham the following year. That is them learning.
Oh, I see.
That you deliberately go into the belly of the beast. You pick a place where the chief of police, he's actually the commissioner of public safety, ironically.
Is a reactionary
whose nickname is Bull. Yeah. Never a good sign in the law enforcement arena, I would argue. In other words, they deliberately go into a place where they know they're going to get a violent response.
Yeah, okay.
So, but still, that's them making up for a mistake.
Yeah, oh, sure, I see. Yeah.
From the previous year. And it's not a big story, but it's a tactical mistake that King and his people made.
It's not very heartening about human nature that, you know, people have to see, in order to feel sorry for a group of nonviolent people, you have to see a group of violent people attacking them.
Exactly. Right. If you're sitting there peacefully and nothing else is happening, that's boring.
Yeah.
But if you're sitting there peacefully and somebody's wailing on you or they're sicking dogs on you, we all love a car wreck. I mean, essentially. And there's also the whole question of strategy, which is in retrospect, you know, and this is sort of Monday morning quarterbacking, but in retrospect, I think a lot of people argue that voting rights should have come first.
Oh,
and not civil rights. Remember, we have a Civil Rights Act 64, we have a Voting Rights Act 65. Okay. You can make an argument in terms of strategy that voting rights should have come first, because then presumably you get the strength at the ballot box, which will allow you to put other things in place.
Okay.
Now, would the outcome have been different? Who knows?
Yeah.
But in other words, he's not immune from legitimate criticism when it comes to the strategy of the movement.
Right? Okay. And some bigots in areas where there was segregation and discrimination in public places might not oppose voting as strongly as eating at the cafe.
Right, or might not be in a position to oppose that as strongly.
Yeah, okay,
right.
Okay.
Well, and also just in terms of the way our system works, right, if you give people the right to vote, then they can put into
position
their politicians and their judges that will then allow other things to come, right?
Yeah, but you might not have the confrontations at Woolworths and things like that where they have...
Correct. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously there are a million different variables here.
Yeah.
I'm just making the broad point that there might have been other ways to do this that might have had different or maybe even better results.
Right, okay.
So
okay.
All of these, I mean, these are just the things I sort of lumped together under the category of, Martin Luther King wasn't perfect. He was a flawed human being, and sometimes he made mistakes. That is, I'm sure, obvious to some people.
Yeah.
Other people, maybe not so much. Right. Because when you airbrush away all the bad stuff and put someone on a pedestal, then you might be surprised to find out some of these things.
Yeah, yeah. And that happens all the time with all sorts of historical figures.
Right. But my more important point is to reclaim the controversial nature of Martin Luther King and his stances on issues later in his life.
Okay, now this is fascinating because we talked about this before we planned this show, and reclaiming the controversy is something that you're trying to do here to show even more significance.
Right, and it's amazing too because everyone, and I mean everyone of all stripes in the 1960s would have said he's a controversial figure.
Yes.
By definition.
Yes.
He's upsetting the apple cart. He's trying to force social and political change in the face of a lot of people who don't want that change to happen. No one would have said he's uncontroversial. But I think, and this once again gets to memory, it gets to popular culture.
Right.
We have, I would argue, made him non-controversial. We have made him we've filed off all the edges.
Mm-hmm.
We've made him into a unifying figure that people from all stripes can get behind.
Right.
And so when we've ripped all the controversy away from him, and I look at this partly chronologically.
Okay.
My belief is that in the popular memory, you basically have a lot of attention, for good reason, paid to the I Have a Dream speech.
Yes.
August 1963, right? The Lincoln Memorial. Yes. Right? Sort of his classic statement in favor of integration, interracial harmony, and perhaps most importantly for our purposes, a colorblind society, right? Where you're judged not by the color of your skin, but by the content of your character. The I Have a Dream speech, which is the famous distillation of his ultimate goal, which is integration, interracial harmony, and a colorblind society.
Yeah.
And so with the possible exception of what happens in 65, the Selma, Alabama, the Voting Rights Act, I think in the popular consciousness, he gets little or no attention between the I Have a Dream speech, 1963, and his assassination, 1968.
Oh, but you mean the popular consciousness now?
Now, yes. I'm sorry.
In the 60s, it was still going
on. Oh, yeah. No, he was still making headlines. He was still a major figure pretty much no matter what he did. But my point is that 5 years between 63 and 68 essentially disappears in public memory.
Okay.
He gives the I Have a Dream speech, which is completely unobjectionable.
Yeah, right? No one could object. Yeah.
No, right? It's not controversial in retrospect. It's about everyone getting along, basically.
Yeah.
And then he's assassinated.
Yeah.
And so my point here is to recover those 5 years, because it's in those 5 years that we get a Martin Luther King, which I think would make a lot of people uncomfortable today. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so we shy away from that because we don't want to anger anybody. We don't want to remember him as a polarizing figure.
Right.
We want to remember him as a unifying figure.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why he gets so much love and Malcolm X not so much.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean,
because everyone thinks of Malcolm X as a polarizing figure.
Exactly right. So much of the 63 to 68 period has been airbrushed out or forgotten because of the controversy. And I think this is unfortunate because the MLK who comes out of this is sort of dumbed down.
He's
reduced to a simple, safe, unidimensional, a feel-good figure for racial harmony.
Okay.
And I think this is really bad history that needs to be corrected.
Okay, the dumbed-downness seems very important to me. We're saying that the weight of popular memory now, 50 years later, only wants to see these two things, the 63 speech and then the tragedy of...
Right, the tragedy of us losing him.
Okay, and there's an awful lot of stuff that needs to be brought up from 63 to 68.
Right, to fully understand him.
Okay, well, let's get to that after this quick sponsorship break. Okay, Professor, we're back. Buzzkillers, we're back talking about the unknown Martin Luther King. You've stressed in the first part of the show so much of this 63 to 68 period that's been airbrushed out, that's been forgotten. What was Martin Luther King doing during that period?
Well, he was doing a bunch of things. And let me just preface this by saying part of the reason it gets forgotten is because he doesn't enjoy nearly as much success in this period. In fact, he also suffers a series of defeats. And so if your narrative, quote unquote, if your narrative is sort of a victory narrative, which it in many ways ought to be, right?
Because
because of his actual role. Yeah, you don't want to focus so much on his defeats and his frustrations, which is largely happens in this period.
Even though in 64 there's the Civil Rights Act, in 65 there's the Voting Rights Act, you can take credit for
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I meant more like after 65, in 66 through his assassination.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and I'll say about some things about those in a minute. But so what is he doing in this period? One thing, amazing to me how much this gets overlooked, is that as of the spring of 1967, he comes out strongly and publicly against the Vietnam War.
Right. Very strongly.
Because, of course, that's controversial today, right? A lot of people today, are against people who are against the war, right?
Yeah,
the protesters,
amazing.
Right? They consider them traitors or hippies or unpatriotic or whatever. So if you cherish a version of Martin Luther King as the great hero, you don't want to admit that he was anti-war. Well, he was strongly anti-war, and by the way, drove Lyndon Johnson nuts. Keep in mind that these are two men who were allies in some ways, right? Especially when you're talking about 64 and 65.
Right.
But Lyndon Johnson did not brook any opposition to the Vietnam War, especially from someone like Martin Luther King. So he was really livid. But Martin Luther King said that this madness has to stop.
Madness is a very strong word.
Yeah, it is. He declared, and this is early 67. This is before Tet. Right. This is before the war really, really, publicly goes bad in early 68. All these anniversaries we're just marking in our own period. He said the madness had to stop. And not only because it was ravaging the black ghettos, right, where a lot of young men were taken to the military and then killed or wounded. And we talked a little bit about this. But army recruiters were very, very active
in
the black inner city. But even more importantly, he was against the war because it was an expensive distraction from the domestic priorities that were more important to him and his people, like Johnson's war on poverty.
Oh, right. And other domestic programs. Yeah.
Right. Remember, by this point, by 67, the United States is running into the guns or butter dilemma. Right?
Yeah,
we've radically expanded the size of the federal government. Right. We're trying to defeat racism and poverty at home. And we're fighting a really, really expensive war overseas.
Yeah. Yeah.
if you're someone like Martin Luther King, the opportunity costs, in other words, what are you not doing at home because you're fighting this war in Vietnam, become huge.
Absolutely.
And become a reason to oppose the war.
Yeah. And especially because the war on, well, poverty affects a lot of black communities so strongly and well into the late 20th century.
Correct. And by the way, as a moral person, Martin Luther King Jr. was also opposed to what the Vietnam War was doing in Vietnam.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
in other words, that we're killing a lot of people, right? We talked about this when we talked about Daniel Ellsberg. If you think the war is wrong, you also think it's wrong. I mean, if the war is wrong, you're killing civilians for no good reason,
right?
Not just combatants. So what else is he doing? He's also confronting economic class.
Now, this is something I'm sure is completely steamrolled by forgotten about by general public, but also by the myth making about
it's appalling. It's not surprising.
Right.
We often, even today, try to basically shy away from open discussions of economic class. A lot of Americans don't want to admit that we have economic classes in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you raise the issue, then you're waging class warfare or whatever.
Yeah.
I was interested to know that the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial in Washington, D.C., which I urge everyone to see, it's a fantastic memorial. It has a whole bunch of quotations of his chiseled into stone. There are no quotations about poverty.
That's just shocking to me. And I've seen it and I've read them all, and it didn't occur to me that there were no quotations about poverty. None of his quotations about poverty.
Now, once again, when you're in the memorial business, you're not trying to piss people off who are coming to the memorial, right?
True.
You I mean, when in doubt, go non-controversial. But then again, it's a memorial to the man and what he did.
Right, yeah.
You ought to make some effort to capture the whole picture, or at least the whole big picture.
Yeah.
It does mention Vietnam briefly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But most of the quotations are about peace and love and justice, i.e. the memorial equivalent of the Lincoln Memorial speech, right?
Sure, sure.
In other words, something that no one, peace, love, and justice, who would object to those?
You mean the Lincoln Memorial speech again is the March
of the I Have a Dream. Yes, yeah, the I Have a Dream speech, right? In other words, it's played up historically because it's non-controversial.
Yeah.
Everyone could get behind it, right? It's like saying you're in favor of good things and against bad things.
And any sane person, yeah.
Exactly. Thank you. But much of the last few years of his life, he actually spent outside the South.
Right.
And even when he was inside the South still, these were campaigns against poverty and joblessness.
Now, do we think that in his mind or in the movement generally, because of 63, the Civil Rights Act, 64 Civil Rights Act, 65 Voting Rights Act, these things, the sort of legislation end of it seems to be sort of on its way to solving itself, and now we need to look at social attitudes?
That's part of it. Also,
okay.
I think what happens in these last few years of his life is Martin Luther King Jr. comes to realize that, you know, that the Civil Rights Movement had been focusing on the most glaring problem,
right,
i.e. Jim Crow segregation and brutality in the South.
Yeah.
But the problems of black community nationwide are a different series of problems, right? It's for example, as I was pointing out in class, why the Watts riots in Los Angeles, August 1965, break out just days after signing of the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, why are we having these massive sort of expressions of discontent
outrage.
And outrage in the black community on the heels of the great victory? Well, it's because blacks in Los Angeles could vote.
Yeah, that's right. And always could vote. Yeah.
The movement, quote unquote, wasn't addressing their issues. Their issues were the much more intractable issues of jobs and housing and informal racial discrimination, not Jim Crow. And so it's, on the one hand, it's a more complicated story because King is tackling more complicated problems.
Yeah.
But he's come to realize that, yeah, once you deal with the formal problems of things like voting and civil rights, now you have to dig deeper and get to the problems of economics.
Yeah, and often those are
poverty.
Much more difficult.
Right. Now, what's interesting to me is that the March on Washington in 1963, already at that point, that the official name of that march was the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom.
Oh, I'm sure that's entirely forgotten. I'd forgotten.
Buzzkillers should go look at almost any photograph from the crowd of that day, August 28th, 1963.
Yeah.
You'll see a lot of signs about jobs.
Yes, that's completely...
Those get lost too, right? It's all about freedom.
Yeah.
It's all about racial equality,
but
nothing about jobs and about how then as now unemployment hits the black community much, much harder than the white community.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a problem, by the way, we still haven't fixed. But so in other words, and this is going to sound really odd, what he discovers is that having tackled the relatively, and I stress relatively easy tasks of civil and voting rights, right? Who would have thought looking at that struggle that was easy?
No.
It turns out it is easier than the problem of taking on poverty.
Yeah.
Right? In a free market economy like ours, how do you put a floor under everybody? Mm-hmm. Right? How mm-hmm. do you make sure everyone has a job? Mm-hmm. So, King, late in his career, undertakes things like the Poor People's Campaign, which spends a lot of time in places like Chicago.
Right.
Right. No, it's not the South. And
this is 67, 68.
This is 67, 68. In some ways, the Poor People's Campaign is a forerunner of the Occupy movement, if you look at how
you
look at how it worked. It's kind of interesting link there. But let's also look at the assassination. Why is he in Memphis, Tennessee in early April 1968? He is there appearing on behalf of striking black sanitation workers.
That's right.
Labor dispute. It's not about integration. I mean, those workers tended to be black, and they were mm-hmm. treated like crap. In fact, there were a couple of black sanitation workers who were killed.
Yes, that's right.
They were not allowed into the building to get out of the rain, and so to get out of the rain, they sort of crouched in the back of a garbage truck, which then basically malfunctioned and crushed them.
It's
horrific. But in other words, that's a great little vignette because he is focusing on economic issues and mm-hmm. labor issues, not race issues per se, not lunch counters or interstate busing or things like that you saw earlier.
Now, not to say, of course, Buzzkillers, that those things had been completely wiped away from American emotions. They hadn't. But legally and constitutionally, right. They were on the way out.
Oh, yeah. And correct. And on the way out. Let's keep in mind that integration or doing away with Jim Crow, doing away with the separate drinking fountains, et cetera, that was a gradual process.
Right,
in the late 60s and early 70s, you could still find aspects of Jim Crow around that hadn't mm-hmm. been removed yet. That mm-hmm. took a while.
But the poverty thing is so much more emotional.
Right.
I mean, so there are emotional aspects to all these things, and they're all horrible, but the poverty has much more emotional.
Well, and it's endemic, and leads me to my next point, and probably perhaps even more controversial, is that Martin Luther King, late in his life, talked a lot about redistribution and compensation.
Okay, now this you never hear.
Right. And that's part
very left wing.
Compensation, in other words, he would, what would he do, right? So what if?
Yeah.
He would not be completely bewildered by talk of reparations.
For slavery. Right.
Or for the way African Americans have been treated over time.
Right, sure, yeah.
So, and this is really, really important because he's not just switching his focus from, say, civil and voting rights to economic issues.
Mm-hmm.
He's also moving to the left when it comes to economic issues.
Yes.
So there are points, for example, when he calls for the nationalization of some industries, which is about as radical as American activists get, right? That's close to communism.
It's American socialism, yeah.
Yes. There are other points where he talks about establishing a guaranteed income.
Right.
Which is something, by the way, that Nixon was also pushing for, oddly enough.
Yeah.
Right? The Family Assistance Program, the mm-hmm. FAP?
It's amazing how left-wing
people like Richard Nixon were,
ironically enough. Yeah.
Toward the end of his life, he advocated an economic bill of rights, which he's not alone. There was a point late in his life when FDR actually talked about an economic bill of rights.
Yes, yes.
So it's not entirely new, but it is certainly radical in the American political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
He also said, and you can see this speech online, there's a speech he gives toward the end of his life, I think it was early 68, and his basic point, not in so many words, is through history, white people have gotten all sorts of help.
From the government, yeah.
From the government.
Absolutely.
Homestead Act, subsidized education, farm price supports. He runs down this whole list.
And
by the way, his command of U.S. history in the speech is actually pretty good.
Yeah. For a politician, political figure.
He's history courses had he taken. But I guess you could argue maybe he didn't have to. But basically, and then he says freed slaves got nothing.
Yeah.
And so in this speech, he's essentially calling for reparations. Not in so many words. He doesn't have a concrete program.
Right.
But he's basically saying, here's the reality. It's not like we never give people any help. And so African Americans are asking for something new.
Or more.
He's just saying African Americans should get some of the things that white people have always been getting.
Right.
Which is a really powerful and radical argument that a lot of people today just could not abide.
Sure. The Homestead Act is a very big one that people forget.
Yeah, that when, you steal all this land from the Indians, you can then give it away for free to white people.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically. So by the way, he also mentions land grant colleges in that same speech.
Oh, right, right.
Which, yeah, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the Homestead Act, you know, going west was not as pioneering as movies and the TV made it out
exactly
to be.
Exactly right. Yeah, basically, in some cases, just move out to the land and claim it.
Yeah.
And that leads me to my last point, which is he was also a fan of affirmative action.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they didn't use the phrase at the time. That phrase,
right, that's that 70s,
label, yeah, that's much, much later. But the idea he was certainly in favor of, and I can't stress how important this is, because once again, people like Ronald Reagan and Rush Limbaugh and others, because of the I Have a Dream speech, have claimed, and we saw this with JFK, we have claimed him for conservatism.
Yes.
And have actually claimed Martin Luther King because he had a vision of a colorblind society, which in some ways and at certain points he did.
Yeah.
Because that's his stance, he's a conservative. And he would have opposed affirmative action.
Because that can also be brought about by self-help, according to Reagan.
Exactly. And by the way, there are points when Martin Luther King Jr. does speak in favor of self-help.
Yeah.
I mean, he moved around a lot and sometimes contradicted himself. Nevertheless, the claim that he would have opposed or was opposed to affirmative action is a myth.
Yeah.
That's a myth. That's today's myth I'm going to bust. Because like I said, Reagan did this, a bunch of others have done it. He said, and I'm quoting here, "A society that has done something special against the Negro for hundreds of years must now do something special for the Negro."
Now, if you took that quote and you changed those words, if you changed them to "a society that has done something special against immigrants, Irish Americans, Germans Americans, Italian Americans for dozens of years must now do something special for Irish Americans,"
right,
that would not be controversial.
Probably not. Or it would certainly be a lot less controversial than this.
Than it was, yeah.
Right? Because, you know, look on the right, look at how just sort of horrifying affirmative action is, right?
For them.
By the way, public opinion polls show this today. Millions of American white people think that the only remaining racism is against them.
Yes, that's right.
And they often point to affirmative action, right? That's racism directed against white people. Well, your great hero, Martin Luther King Jr., was okay with affirmative action. If you look at something like Operation Breadbasket, which was one of his programs, the SCLC launched it in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
This called, among other...
SCLC again, Leadership Conference.
Yeah, that was his official religious group. This was one of the leading groups in the civil rights movement. The Operation Breadbasket called on companies to hire X number of black people.
Right, okay.
You and I today would call a quota.
Right.
That's not just affirmative action. That's a particularly extreme form of affirmative action.
Sure.
Right.
Sure,
affirmative action exists in all sorts of different ways.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Like, for example, do you take race into a consideration when you hire or admit someone to college?
Mm-hmm.
This is toward the more extreme end. In other words, you must hire or should hire X number of black people.
Right.
That's a quota.
Yeah.
He also likened affirmative action, not using the term once again, but likened affirmative action to the GI Bill.
Now, that's a good question, because so often we think of the GI Bill as benefiting all servicemen coming back, but we don't actually know whether a lot of African Americans were able to take advantage of it, or whether it was regionally distributed differently.
Correct. And also, to me, the more important point is he looks at veterans as essentially a privileged class. In other words, this is a group of people. All they have in common is the fact that they serve in the military, and we do something special for them.
Yeah.
And he would say, why wouldn't we do the same thing for African Americans?
Right.
Now, obviously, that itself is a controversial stance and a controversial analogy he's drawing.
Yeah.
But that's the way he thought of this. And the idea that today we would say, oh, because he favored a colorblind society, he would have been opposed to affirmative action. Well, if you look at his actual words and writings, it's pretty clear he was in favor of redistribution and compensation and some sort of what we would call affirmative action.
Right, right.
So
this is all happening again. Of course, it all has to happen before 68, so to speak. But in many ways, he has moved further left between the March on Washington and his assassination.
Exactly. And if you acknowledge today how far left he moved, he becomes more and more controversial. He's going to lose adherence. He's not going to be this sort of generic feel-good character.
Right.
And so that gets dropped.
Okay.
Because it's unpleasant.
Well, let's take a quick station ID break, and we'll get back to talking more about that last point in a moment.
Hello, this is Sebastian Buzzkill. Please support my daddy by going to ProfessorBuzzkill.com and clicking on the Patreon button. While you're there, subscribe to his email list and shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. Follow him on Facebook, on Twitter, at BuzzkillProf, and on Instagram, at Professor Buzzkill. Professor Buzzkill is part of Entertainment One's podcast network. It's available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Please leave a review while you're there. Thanks for listening.
Okay, we're back. Now, Professor, what you've done here is complicated the story of MLK's political contributions to the country, complicated the story of what happens between 63 and 68, but it's more important than that, isn't it?
Sure. My main message here is that Martin Luther King Jr. was far more radical in his last years than many people realize.
Uh-huh.
You know, and once again, let's keep in mind his image. His image is of a fairly conventional, or maybe not conventional, but conservative, sort of socially conservative figure, right? Obviously, he's a religious leader. I think we generally remember him as wearing a jacket and a tie.
Yeah.
Although, if you look at a lot of the pictures of him out taking part in protests, they're sometimes much more casually dressed than that, or wearing sunglasses. I'm pretty sure there's one photo, at least one photo out there of him wearing a dashiki.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
So once again, like pick your Martin Luther King Jr. image.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he seems pretty clean cut, pretty socially conservative guy.
Especially compared to what we might call, well, what is generally called the radical wing of the civil rights movement.
Or the radical wing of the American left in the 1960s, right?
Sure, sure.
We have a picture of them, and then we have a picture of him, and those pictures don't intersect.
No.
And my point is that they probably ought to.
Right.
Because when you start talking about redistribution and affirmative action, you know, that puts him pretty far in the left, not only now, but then too, right? You know, that puts him, you know, to the left of someone like Hubert Humphrey, you know, who's a
true
classic New Deal liberal running for president in 1968.
True.
So I would argue that more broadly, we do neither King's legacy nor ourselves any favors. And I've made this message before. I'm going to sound like a broken record, but we do neither King's legacy nor ourselves any favors by canonizing or prettifying or I would say defanging him. In other words, like rendering him harmless, rendering him cuddly, or whatever adjective you want to use.
We wouldn't have had the further race riots post 68 if he had lived, that sort of thing.
Right.
The defanging one is the thing that upsets me the most, because that takes out the sort of drive and energy that he's put into all this work his whole life.
Right. And also just sort of calling America on its lies, basically.
Right. Yeah.
This is the land of opportunity. And in the late 60s, he would have said, well, no, it isn't. Go to the black community.
Yeah, that's
look at the poverty. Look at the despair. Look at the joblessness. Look at the substandard housing. Mm-hmm. Look at the de facto Jim Crow in the North.
Right.
Look at these broken schools. Right. Look at all the things that look at all the conditions that lead to dozens of urban riots between 1964 and 1968.
Right.
In places like Newark and Chicago and Detroit, where they have to deploy American soldiers just back from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we said that doesn't just come from the fact that black people couldn't vote in the South.
No, that's
right. These are systemic, and America needs to grapple with them. And that's a message a lot of Americans, even liberals, really don't want to hear.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I would say, but by recognizing his flaws as a human.
Yeah. Right.
And by refusing
and acknowledging that they are human,
and that he's human, and that he made mistakes, and that he was a problematic figure in his personal life, and a lot of other things, and that he was a plagiarist, things like that, and by doing that, by acknowledging those, and by refusing to gloss over his controversial views, I would say that we basically banish the saint and reveal the human.
Right. Okay.
That's good for his place in history, and that's good for us.
Okay.
Because I would argue that if you're looking for inspiration, and I think that's one of his continuing roles, is as an inspiring figure.
Yeah.
People may disagree. I would argue we are more inspired by a human than by a saint.
Ah, okay.
Right?
We probably think more about what a human has to say.
And feel more of a connection to him. If he's up on a pedestal and seems flawless, there might be a little voice in you that says, well, you couldn't hope to achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He's just so out of your league. But if you... let me put it this way. If you knock him down one peg, he goes up three pegs.
Yeah.
Because, right? Because if he becomes more human, if he becomes flawed, and you recapture his controversial nature and have an honest discussion about what he stood for, then I think you can use him in a way that's a tribute to him and a tribute to history.
And that's where his greatness can come through.
Exactly right. Right. Exactly right.
Okay. Okay, so what I've hoped we've done here in this episode is not only we've shown how complicated he was as a man, but how ultimately, as you say, if you bring him down one or two pegs, he's already so many pegs up there that we're talking about a really great American.
Well,
and a really great.
Right. Well, in other words, there's a qualitative issue. In other words, you knock him down one bad peg, but you bring him up three good pegs.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. And part of that is knowing the detail.
That's right.
All the detail of what you're talking between 63 and 68 needs to be brought back up.
Right. But and like I said, and you have to embrace the whole man and the whole legacy and the whole series of stances he took and not just cherry pick.
Right. Okay. Well, there you have it, Buzzkillers. And we'll talk to you next week.